Good evening, everyone. Broadcasting live, April 14th. Today's quote is from the Brahma Sutra. There once was a Brahmin named Brahmayu, living in Mithila. Why does that name sound familiar? Isn't that the let's see. Yeah, that is. That's the capital. That's where that's the residence of King Janaka in the Janaka Mahajanaka Jataka and the Mahaumagga Jataka, the Mahosada Jataka. See where Mithila was. Generally identified with Janakapura. Ah, there is a place called Janakapura. That's interesting. Huh. Probably been through it. Janakpur. I'll have to look into that. Right, so Mithila is a famous place. Nothing to do with our quote though. Still interesting. So this Brahmin, Brahmayu, sends his student Uttara to go and see the Buddha, right? And what's neat about this sutta is it gives some details about the Buddha's life, the Buddha's manner, that really stick with you. So it talks about the 32 marks of a great man, which a great being, which are, well, they're all physical. So the Buddha had a specific physical shape. He was not like an ordinary human being in many different ways. But then it goes on, after the 32 marks, it gets into interesting stuff. And so one of them is the quote that we have today, but there's several here. When he walks, he steps out with the right foot first. He does not extend his foot too far or put it down too near. So when we do walking meditation, we always tell the meditators to walk with the right foot first. And maybe this is a reason for it. It's kind of just, there's obviously nothing special about the right foot, although seems to be a habit of the Buddha, so every time you walk with the right foot first, you can think, well, I'm doing it the way the Buddha did it. Kind of give you some encouragement, make you think of the Buddha. He walks neither too quickly nor too slowly. This is the answer that my teacher gives when someone asks whether they should do walking meditation quickly or slowly. Should I slow down? Should I do it quickly? Not too quickly, not too slowly. He walks without his knees knocking together. He walks without his ankles knocking together. He walks without raising or lowering his thighs or bringing them together or keeping them apart. When he walks, only the lower part of his body oscillates. And he does not walk with bodily effort. when he turns to look, he does so with his whole body. This is called the elephant gaze, or it's one way of interpreting what is called the elephant gaze. The Buddha, he wouldn't often turn, but when he did, he would turn his whole body like an elephant, because if an elephant's going to look behind itself, it has to turn all the way around. It's another particular idiosyncrasy of a Buddha. And so he did this when he came out of Vaisali, I think, 3 months before, or sometime before he entered into Parinibbana. He turns around and looks at Vaisali and says, this is the last time I'm going to see this town. He knew he wasn't ever going to come back. He does not look straight up, he does not look straight down, he does not walk looking about, he looks a plow yoke's length before him. Beyond that, he has unhindered knowledge and vision. So he looks about 6 feet out. When he goes indoors, he does not raise or lower his body or bend it forward or back. He turns neither too far from the seat nor too near it. He does not lean on the seat with his hand. He does not throw his body onto the seat. So when he comes near a seat to sit upon, he turns to sit on it, but he does it. This is a guy, having observed the Buddha and relating this back to his teacher, just how incredible the Buddha was. You know, just how impressive he was in every little meticulous detail. And so it's a unique look. It's, I think, the only place where we really have this much detail about the Buddha. When seated indoors, he does not fidget with his hands, he does not fidget with his feet. He does not sit with his knees crossed, he does not sit with his ankles crossed. He does not sit with his hand holding his chin. When seated indoors, he is not afraid, he does not shiver and tremble, he is not nervous. Being unafraid, not shivering or trembling or nervous, his hair does not stand up, and he is intent on seclusion. Intent on seclusion even when he is in a crowd. When surrounded by people, all he is thinking about is seclusion. His mind is focused on seclusion. And part of the implication is getting out of there as soon as possible. And at one point the Buddha says that he teaches in whatever way he can to get rid of, to make the person leave as quickly as possible. Which is curious, because you think, well, that's kind of how rude of him to think like that. But it's really kind of special to think of, you know, because you can't, you know, it's not about dismissing people. It's about working out your karma with them. If someone comes to you, there's some kind of relationship there. And it's interesting how you find if you reject people, if you just reject them outright, they're going to come back. You're building up karma with them. And they will come back, if not in this life, in the next. But usually in this life, they'll come back and there'll still be that tension. But to really get rid of someone, you have to work everything out so that you're free from that karma, the debt or the concerns of people come and accuse you or come and attack you or even come and ask you questions. If you don't satisfy them, there's tension there. So you have to do your part. Sometimes if someone's yelling at you, you don't have to appease them. Sometimes, like the Buddha said, you get angry at me, I don't get angry at you, you get to keep the anger. Just like you bring me a gift, I don't take the gift. But it's a kind of a curious, not how people would think of someone like the Buddha. They think, oh yes, he's so compassionate and he wants to help people. Not really. He would help people in whatever way he can to end it, to be free from that burden or the interaction. Because it's all about it's all about working yourself to be free. If you want to teach people how to be free, you have to be free yourself. So that one, if you don't put your own freedom first, you're not teaching other people to be free, you're teaching other people to be trapped. You yourself have to be free to be able to teach it. So, always concerned with seclusion. When he receives water, he does not raise. It talks about water. Like every little thing, he washes the bowl out without making a splashing noise and so on. You should read through this. It's Majjhima Nikaya number 91. When he receives rice, he turns, he does not exceed the right amount of sauce in the mouthful. He turns the mouthful over two or three times in his mouth and then swallows it. And no rice kernel enters his body unchewed, and no rice kernel remains in his mouth. So every single rice kernel is chewed before it goes down his throat. And no rice kernel remains in his mouth, then he takes another mouthful. So not even a single rice kernel is left before he goes for the next mouthful. He takes his food experiencing the taste, though not experiencing greed for the taste. I wonder how this guy knew all this. He must have been very observant. Or perhaps this has been embellished or extrapolated. The food he takes has eight factors. It is neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of his body, for the ending of discomfort, for the assisting the holy life. He considers, thus shall I terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. This is actually the reflection that we make before we eat, and Bhikkhu Bodhi says the same. This is the standard reflection of the proper use of alms food. Patisankha yoni so pindapatang patiseva mineva davaya namadaya namandanaya navibhusanaya yavadeva imasakaya sa titiyaya panaya vihing suparatiya brahmacharya nukahaya iti purananchu vedanang patihankami navanchu vedanang na upade sami yatra jame bhavi satya navachata napasu navachata japasu viharuchati. We say that before we eat, usually, as a reflection. So he probably heard the Buddha say that, you know, this must be how the Buddha eats. And after he's eaten, detail about eating. He walks neither too fast nor too slow. His robe is worn neither too high nor too low. He washes his feet, he sits mindfully, his mindset on welfare, on his own welfare, on the welfare of others, on the welfare of both, even on the welfare of the whole world. When he is, and here's the quote that we have today: when he has gone to the monastery, he teaches the Dhamma to an audience. He neither flatters nor berates his audience. He instructs, urges, and encourages it with talk purely on the Dhamma. No, this isn't that. I don't think the quote is in this sutta, is it? I think he's got the wrong sutta. Oh yeah, no, this is it. The speech has, let me see, sorry, quote this. Yeah, it has eight qualities. Okay, yeah, this is this quote. He neither flatters nor berates the audience. He instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages it with talk purely on the Dhamma. The speech that issues from his mouth has eight qualities. It is distinct, intelligible, melodious, audible, ringing, euphonious, deep, and sonorous. But while his voice is intelligible as far as the audience extends, his speech does not issue out beyond the audience. Kind of magical. When the people have been instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened by him, they rise from their seats and depart, looking only at him and concerned with nothing else. It's an inspiring quote. I mean, this sutta has a lot about inspiration rather than instruction. And a lot of it is about the Buddha himself and about his great qualities and how impressive he was. As a sort of an aid to help us think and appreciate who the Buddha actually was. It's useful in that way. It's impressive. Having an impressive role model, example, this is, there's a definite benefit to it. And so that's what we use suttas like this for. On the other hand, I mean, in the end, the Buddha does come and teach some things. Let me see. What does he actually get around to teaching? Here we go. He asks the Buddha some questions. How does one become a Brahmin? And how does one attain knowledge? Let's see if we can find the Pali. Katangko Brahmano hoti katthang bhavati vedago Tevijo bho katthang hoti sotiyo kinti vuchati Arahang bho katthang hoti katthang bhavati kevali Municha bho katthang hoti buddho kinti vuchati. A lot of questions. Even in the Buddha's time, they had all sorts of questions. How does one become a Brahmin? How does one become Vedagu, one who has gone to Vedas, to knowledge, wisdom? Devijja, how does one become triple knowledge? How is one called a Muni, a scholar, a sage? How does one become an Arahant? How does one attain completeness? What's that? Bhavati Kevali, yeah. Full accomplishment. How is one a silent sage? Muni cha bho katang hoti. Oh no, sorry, the first one wasn't Muni, it was Soti, which is a learned man. So Muni is How is one a Muni? How is one called a Buddha? So here is the Buddha's teaching. Let's find the teaching. Pubeni va sangyo vedi saggapayancha pasati atto jati kayang patto abhinya vosito muni. One who knows their past lives, who sees heaven and hell, who has attained the ending of birth. What is mosito? One who has accomplished in higher knowledge, abhinya, such a person is a muni. Chittang visuddhang janati muttang ragehi sabbaso. They know the purification of mind, or the pure mind. They know the pure mind. Muttang ragehi sabbaso, free from raga entirely, altogether free from raga, from passion and desire. Pahina jati marano brahmachariyasa kevali. One is complete who has abandoned birth and death through the holy life. Is it through the holy life? Oh, I see. One who has abandoned birth and death, one who has completed the holy life, become complete, come to the completion of the holy life. Paragu sabba dhammanang buddho tadi pochati. One who has gone to the farther shore, to the final, ultimate knowledge. Paragu means literally one who has gone to the other shore. But it's a word the Buddha uses often in a metaphorical sense of one who has gone to the end, who has seen through to completion. Sabbadhammanang, who has come to the end of all dhammas, or who has come to know and come to be complete in regards to all dhammas. buddhodadi pochati. Then, or thus, buddhodadi, such a person is called a Buddha. And then the Buddha gave him more instruction, which is Atuko Anupubhinkatangatesi. Then he gave the Anupubhikata, which we call the Anupubhikata, the teaching in order. So he taught him about dana, about charity, sila, morality, sangha, about heaven, kama nangadinawang, the adinawang ukarang sankide sambi, disadvantages, the degradation and the defilement, impurity of sensuality. Nekamme anisangsang, the benefits of renunciation. The Majjhima Nikaya is really pretty awesome. It's got 152 suttas on all sorts of subjects. So you find all sorts of gems about all sorts of things. Anyway, there's some Dhamma for this evening. So we have two meditators, and they both finished today. Did really well. I can certify both of them as having finished the course, which is awesome. Not certify, but I can vouch for them having done a really good job in their course. And I finished two exams, so I wrote about Buddhism this morning, Buddhism in East Asia, the three questions. The neat thing about it, our professor is, I think he's a practicing Buddhist, and he was conscious of the amount of stress that people have, so he gave us the exam in advance. He did the same with the midterm, but he gave us the final exam to prepare in advance, so it was fairly stress-free for most of the class, as far as worrying about what's going to be on it or about any surprises or about what to study. It was quite clear what you had to study. It's just a matter of putting in the time. And so I wrote about practice and belief. The first section was a short answer, so it was a shorter answer, short essay about practice versus belief. Because in East Asia, in most religion, of course, the most obvious relationship between belief and practice is how our belief informs our practices, right? This is fairly standard. But I looked at the other ways as well, right? I mentioned the other, how it's possible for one's practice to influence one's beliefs in the sense that one can be forced into certain practices or have influences leading one to practice in other ways. For example, the state in China, in Korea, in Japan, had a pretty heavy hand on Buddhist practitioners and monks and teachers and so on. And so they were often compelled to practice in certain ways. And this would have influenced people's beliefs. Also, practices, worldly practices, or people's desires and attachments and views and egos and so on, would have affected people's belief and how they interpreted the Dhamma. And another way of looking at these two is how belief and practice can sometimes conflict. We've got this interesting thing. Pure Land Buddhism is really weird. I'm not really impressed. But here's the idea with Pure Land. See, there was this guy, Genshin, who said that reciting the Buddha's name, and in fact not our Buddha, but another Buddha, was the best practice. Okay? So he said, there's all these other practices, but reciting the name Amitabha is the best practice. Okay, so this is his idea. The next guy who came along was named Honen. And Honen privately, he didn't go public with it in the beginning, but he wrote a book in private that said that practice is useless. And the only thing that's effective is reciting the Buddha's name. Okay, so he's gone another step. The next guy who came along, Shinran, went even farther. If you read about these guys, it's like, oh dear, they went further and further. It was like interpretation of interpretation. So Shinran says, not only is practice is not just useless, practice is actually harmful. Why is practice harmful? And he said, his quote was that a good person will get, let me see, even a good person can get into, no, that's not the quite the quote, but it twisted it. He said, it was basically saying that evil people have an easier time getting to the Pure Land than good people. And why is that? Because good people practice Buddhism, and by practicing Buddhism, they're showing that they don't have faith in Amitabha, right? Because otherwise, why would you practice? If you had perfect faith in Amitabha, you're just like, well, I'll wait for Amitabha to save me. Amitabha will take me to the Pure Land. So his idea was that evil people, because they don't practice, because really scary stuff, actually. I mean, this is a quote of his, and it's really not Buddhism as I understand it. So we've had some debates about this, and in class, right before the exam, I said to one of the students, I said, I said, this really isn't Buddhism anymore. And she kind of smiled, and I said, I know, I mean, what I have to say is it's a different type of Buddhism. And she kind of smiled again, and like, because we understand that, it's like the no true Scotsman fallacy. If you ever look up the no true Scotsman fallacy, you can't just say someone's not a Buddhist if they claim to be Buddhist. But I said, but here's the thing. Buddhism, if a religion arises, and when it arises, its core doctrine is X, and then later a new doctrine arises, not X. If the new doctrine takes not X, how can you call it the same religion, right? It's like, okay, you can adapt and reinterpret things, but if something is X, and then this is very much not X, Pure Land Buddhism. Anyway, so I had to talk about these kinds of things. The two longer essays were about decline and the individual versus the state. So decline is, I mean, again, these are much more related to East Asian Buddhism than Buddhism as we practice it, or I practice it. So again, it's kind of scholarly, as opposed to practical. But anyway, I talked about decline and how decline, or decline of the Dhamma. It's interesting to ask whether the Dhamma is actually considered to be declining, or what's more understood to be the case is people's ability to practice the Dhamma. The Dhamma doesn't change, right? The Dhamma, but one exception is the fact that the Dhamma becomes corrupt. You see, because we don't really know exactly what the Buddha taught. We claim that in Theravada we have the original teachings. We may not, but at any rate, supposing even that we did, even those teachings are reinterpreted and are mixed with new teachings and replaced by new teachings and that kind of thing. So this is how the Dhamma becomes corrupted, and the decline of the Dhamma is when people stop paying attention to the deep teachings, and they promote surface teachings, like, well, I would say like the Lotus Sutra, or even worse, there are sutras like the Sutra of Humane Kings, the Golden Light Sutra, that are very, very worldly and much more about empire building and state building than anything, which is what I got into the second, in the final question about individual versus state. Individuals tend to affect religion in unpredictable ways, idiosyncratic. You know, they come up with their own ideas and they create innovation. Whereas the state, on the other hand, is all about stifling innovation, systematizing, controlling, manipulating, using for their own purposes. So they tend to be more predictable. Anyway, so that was my second exam. Yeah, I did really well on both exams. Neither one was that difficult, as it turns out. On Sunday we had this storytelling thing. I don't think I've talked about that yet. It went really well. I told a story. I think I went way over time. I think we all kind of went way over time. My story was quite short, so I thought, oh, I'll have to talk about it. And I think I ended up talking too long. But it was really well appreciated. The First Nations guy said, good words. What a kid. And sat back down. It's quite a character. And tomorrow I'm off to New York, so I actually should probably go and start preparing for my trip. But I'll be gone for 9 days. I would think I'll probably do, as long as they have internet, I'll do some audio broadcasts. So I'll try my best, depending on the time. I think my schedule is mostly afternoon stuff. I'm not even, you know, I'm kind of taking it day by day, of course, but I should look at the New York schedule. As long as I'm not busy, I'll try to broadcast every night, just audio. So you can find the audio here at meditation.sirimangalo.org. Anyway, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Have a good night, and be well.